From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hi, everyone, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson. I know every week I always say that we're going to be joined by a very special guest, but this week it's particularly true. This week, I'm really happy to be talking with Caitlin Hemicky, who's a very good friend of mine. Caitlin and I were both Fulbright English teaching assistants. She was in 2012, I was in 2011, so we've known each other for quite some time. And now Caitlin is back in Seoul as a Fulbright researcher, doing a really fascinating project on Korean adoptees. Caitlin's project focuses mainly on the search for birth families, and she has been talking with many Korean adoptees about the process, about their experiences, how they went about trying to find their birth parents, why they decided to conduct a search, and much more. So Caitlin, thank you for taking the time to talk with me about your work.
Thank you for having me.
So just to get us started, can you tell us a little bit about your background and what inspired you to study the topic of Korean adoptees and their experiences searching for their birth parents in Korea?
So I'm a Korean adoptee myself. So obviously I have personal interest and investment in adoption issues. But honestly, I did not know anything about Korea or adoption history or current adoption issues until pretty recently. So the first time I came to Korea was in 2012, right after I finished undergrad. And before that point, I knew literally nothing and was not even aware that there was a growing adoptee community here in Korea, doing a lot of activism work, trying to put organizations and support networks in place for adoptees who are searching for their birth families, or even just trying to live here and settle here. I was completely unaware of all of that, and really didn't even become that aware of it until the end of my time here. But as I was living in Korea and became more interested in the community here, that drove me to go to grad school and get my master's with a concentration on adoptee literature. So my undergraduate background is in creative writing and literature. So that's why I take that kind of angle into it. So I went and got a master's in focusing on adoptee memoir. That was what I wrote my thesis about. And what struck me about the literature I was studying, as well as kind of just the historical reading I was doing, everything I learned about the birth family search process, it tends to, in the media in particular, the birth family search and reunion process tends to be very one-dimensional. It's very much like, you know, the lost wayward adoptee is searching for herself and her identity. So she wants to find herself and find her roots and know where she came from and that kind of thing. And that, you know, it's this kind of very pitiful portrayal that then becomes this very over-sentimentalized, tearful reunion with dramatic music crescendoing in the background as the mother and lost child embrace for the first time. You know, it's this very, very kind of not dynamic, not nuanced kind of story that gets told, when in reality, the process is far more complicated than that. So, and birth family search in particular is really, really difficult. There aren't a lot of great statistics out there. The most recent one I've seen was from 2012 to 2015. Of the adoptees in those 3 years who searched for their birth families, which I think it was around 5,000 people maybe, of those people, only 14.7%, I think, percent of them were successful. And that's probably the highest statistic that I've seen. The lowest I've seen is 2%. And when you think about that, there's been probably over 200,000 Korean adoptees since adoption began, if only somewhere in the single digits or low teen percent are able to find their birth families. That's a lot of people who can't. So I was interested in tackling this topic for research, basically hoping to find even some small way to make it better, to increase those chances even just a little bit.
So just to clarify, you're talking about around 14% of the people who even tried to find their birth family, right?
Right. So that, I mean, so that's part of it, right? I don't know. I've never seen an exact number of, you know, this many adoptees have tried to search for their birth families. But especially these days, it's becoming a lot more common, I think, just given the internet, for one thing, there's a huge adoptee community just online. So people find each other online and talk about their experiences, and that drives other people to say, oh, maybe I'll try it too. With things like DNA testing, that's becoming a tool that the adoptee community is trying to use to facilitate birth family searches. You know, we're making databases of people who have done DNA tests, and also encouraging Korean birth parents who see this kind of thing on the news or whatever to come forward and do a DNA test so that they can get matched in the database, hopefully, with a child that they had to relinquish in the past.
So obviously everyone has a different experience, but are there any general themes that have emerged from the conversations and the interviews that you've been doing so far?
So it's fascinating and frustrating to talk to people about this kind of thing. I think because of maybe the lack of patterns, and that's one reason why I'm doing the interviews, is to hopefully find some. But what's really frustrating, I guess, is that birth family search really just seems like such a crapshoot, which on one level makes sense that, of course, everyone's story is different. The circumstances under which somebody was relinquished for adoption, that's different for everybody. But it seems to be so dependent on, you know, which social worker you talk to that day when you try to go file a request, or who happens to be in the office when you go and try to ask to see your adoption file. If it's somebody nice or somebody who doesn't know any better, maybe they'll let you. And if it's not, then they'll say, no, you're not allowed to see that. And when you think about how this is dealing with someone's like personal information and their personal history, and it's, you know, it's just up to somebody else who gets to decide if they feel like letting you see this information or not, that seems just so unfair, right? Everyone has different reasons for why they want to search. You know, some people just want to search for medical history, or something that I've noticed in both literature and discussing with people. A lot of adoptees become more interested in searching for their birth parents after they become parents. So it's only once they have their own child and they start to think about what their own parents must have been like that tends to happen, I think. Something I'm interested in is, so a lot of the times in an adoption file, there might be like a short narrative of what happened, of why a mother decided to relinquish the child. I'd be really curious to like take a large set of records and compare those stories, because it's very possible that there might have just been a kind of like stock base of stories that just like they're usually very vague, like young unmarried couple, or, you know, the father failed in a business and so they didn't have any money. But it's like really vague, and it just seems like it's maybe cynical to say, but it seems possible that the agencies might have just had this kind of like set, they just like slapped the same story on every record, because I'm interested in analyzing language as well. So what language do they use in those kinds of narratives? How do they describe the birth parents? How do they describe their thought process behind all of that? That's something I'm interested in finding out more about.
That's super interesting. I'm wondering if you can expand a little more. I know you talked about how the record may not be very detailed, or that adoptees may or may not be given access to their files, and that these blocks tend to come up that make it difficult to search for the birth family. Can you walk us through the process a little bit more? What happens when an adoptee decides, okay, I want to search for my birth family? What is the process like from there?
Yeah. So some adoptees and or their adoptive parents, they might already have a copy of their adoption records. The amount of information they might have in that file can vary. Also, the degree to which the information is true varies pretty widely as well. Either way, usually the first step is to contact the adoption agency. Some people choose to try the American agency first. Some go straight to the Korean agency. And even if you don't have any information, if you just know which agency you were adopted through, it's pretty easy to just, you know, go online and find the contact email. So, you know, you can contact the agency to request that they start a birth family search, and or you can request to see a copy of your file. So once you kind of start that process, there's usually some paperwork you have to fill out. You have to check some boxes. Like, if you were in foster care, do you also want to try to find your foster parents? Do you want to, you know, send a picture or send a letter to your birth parents so that the agency has something to show them if they manage to find them? That kind of thing. And that whole process, though, I think varies by agency as well. I know that some agencies, if you go through the American agency, they insist that they have to be kind of your mediator between you and the Korean agency. So which makes it kind of more inefficient, right? Because there's a third party in the middle being like, no, we have to set up all your appointments and we have to, you know, take care of the paperwork or whatever. And so you're kind of like communicating through them. Some American agencies insist on doing that. I'm not sure, I guess, what in terms of fees, sometimes, you know, they'll charge a fee for those kinds of services, or they'll strongly suggest you make a donation to the agency or something like that. So that all varies by agency. But once an agency starts a birth family search, again, depending who you go through, they have to check the file and see if there are names, addresses, identification numbers, so like Korean equivalent of like a social security number, if those kinds of things are on file and if they're accurate. And one kind of infamous technique, I guess, that a lot of the adoptee community knows about, the Korean agencies often use telegrams to try to contact birth families, like literally, yeah, like a telegram that gets sent to whatever address they have on file. And I've never seen one myself, but I've heard from several people that the message in the telegram is very vague. It's something along the lines of like, a foreigner is looking for you, not being clear at all that it's an adoptee who's looking for their birth family, which again, like on one level sort of makes sense because for a lot of birth parents, it can be a secret from the past or that kind of thing. They don't want people to know that they had to give up a child at some point. But on the other hand, I've heard that a lot of Koreans will get that in the mail and be like, this is clearly junk mail. Like, this is some kind of spam. So they just throw it out or they just, you know, don't even look at it. Which, yeah, I would do the same thing if I got a weird message like that in the mail. So there's the infamous telegrams. I think depending on the agency, they try to send them up to a certain number of times if there's no response. So if that reaches a dead end, like say they've sent a telegram 3 times with no response within this many number of months, or, you know, they might make phone calls if they have a number on file and sometimes whoever answers the phone denies that it's them, then other steps that adoptees can take, again, I mentioned the DNA testing. Usually when you do the DNA test, like 23andMe is a popular one. Once you get your results, you can take the raw data from that test and you can upload it into other like third-party websites that are just kind of like databases. So there are a couple of different adoptee databases being run and you can kind of like search and compare if you've got any relatives within those databases. Since it's mostly adoptees, right? It's this kind of tool is only as helpful as the number of people who take the test, right? Who as many people are in the database. So most people, they only find, you know, really, really distant cousins, like fourth, fifth plus cousins. I have seen a couple instances on the internet of people finding closer cousins or even siblings. So that's why, you know, people are really pushing for people to do these DNA tests. Other steps you can take, if you're in Korea, you can go to the police station and register yourself as a missing person, which, you know, sounds kind of sad, but you can also leave a DNA sample with the police registry. I've heard it's pretty uncommon for, say, if a Korean birth parent, you know, they're not just going to happen to go leave their DNA, you know, in a police station, because usually that's something that criminals have to do. But that is an option, and that is something that has worked for people. If a birth family is actively searching for their child, there have also been plenty of adoptees who will do something. They'll go on TV, they'll go on Korean TV, whether it's the news or in the past, there were programs that were specifically themed on reuniting people. There was one called, like, I Miss That Person, something like that. There used to be several. I don't think they're actually on the air anymore. But that was where those very sentimental kind of, like, dramatic reunions were often on the air. Or some, you know, some adoptees will just go, like, they'll audition for a music program just so that when they introduce themselves on the show that they can tell their story and say, like, I'm an adoptee, I'm looking for my birth family. There have also been a couple of documentary style programs that have aired. And then, you know, usually the documentary focuses on a specific person searching for their family or what they're doing in Korea. But then sometimes at the end, they'll have clips of a bunch of adoptees with like their name and a baby picture in there. Yeah. So there are shows like that as well. Some people are rightfully uncomfortable with doing that kind of thing. They don't really want to put themselves out there that way. But sometimes if you've really hit a dead end with your search and you still really, really want to find your birth family and you've got no other option, that's something you can do. You can just try to put yourself out there. Newspapers, flyers, posting around. If you know the neighborhood you were born in, some people go and they hand out like missing person type flyers. They'll usually put like a baby picture and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of different things you can do. But again, it's not easy.
So far, we've been talking about your current project, about the birth parent search. But as you mentioned at the beginning of our interview, you've also studied writing, adoptee narratives and literature, that kind of thing. Can you tell us a little bit more about that work and some of the writing you've done?
Yeah, so I've kind of dabbled all over the place. Again, my undergraduate background was in creative writing and literature, but not adoptee literature specifically. I didn't get into that until grad school. So when I was in grad school, I was doing mostly the literature focus. So for example, my thesis, this is really nerdy, but my thesis was taking literary trauma theory and applying that to adoptee memoir. The creative writing is just a thing that I do on my own mostly. I've written a couple of essays for conferences, or I had one published in the Lit Mag Brevity this past year. And the other thing that I've kind of been dipping my toes in, I guess, is discourse analysis. So that's looking on a language level how power structures are reflected in language. So with another adoptee friend that I met in grad school, we're working on one project on adoption agency blogs. So looking at the way these agencies are constructing the narrative of adoption on their websites and what that says about, yeah, again, where the power lies in this process. Because unsurprisingly, the power lies with adoption agencies and adoptive parents. The adoptees and the birth parents are, they're passivized or erased entirely from the narrative. So we've looked at that, and we've also started one analyzing adoptee writing. So basically looking at the opposite, how are adoptees pushing back against that kind of dominant narrative that's in place, constructed by usually adoption agencies or adoptive parents. I've kind of like dipped all over the place, but that's some of the stuff that I work on.
I do want to ask you about this because it was in the news a bit ago and it's been getting a lot of attention. Some of our listeners may have heard about the case of Adam Krapser, who was adopted from Korea as a child, but whose adoptive parents didn't file the paperwork properly and he was never naturalized as an American citizen. So now he's lived his entire life as an American, doesn't speak Korean, did not necessarily know anything about his birth family, and he was deported back to Korea at the end of last year. So is there anything being done to try to fix this type of situation in the future?
Yes. So I guess first to give a little bit of background on that, in the year 2000, President Clinton signed the Child Citizenship Act, which that granted citizenship automatically to foreign-born children, so including adoptees, but only if they were 18 years or older as of like February 2001. So, you know, it was only if you were born before a certain date. So that's the big loophole through which people like Adam, they were not eligible to that automatic citizenship even after, you know, their parents had failed to get it for them. So there is a push right now for Congress to pass a bill called the Adoptee Citizenship Act, which would basically close that loophole. It would grant automatic citizenship to all adoptees, regardless of when they were born. So there is there's an organization called the Adoptee Rights Campaign. They're lobbying for this to get passed. They're doing a lot of work on that. So I know they've run a postcard campaign. You can call or write to your senators and representatives. So, and I know that they sometimes have workshops. Like they had a workshop at, there's an adoptee guest house called Korut here in Seoul. And there was a big adoptee conference this past August called The Gathering. So the Adoptee Rights Campaign they gave a presentation, you know, on their work during that conference. So yeah, for listeners who are interested in getting involved in that kind of thing, they can just go online, go to adopteerightscampaign.org. And they've got a whole list on there of all the ways that you can push for this to get passed. I think it's making some progress, the last I just heard. So it's getting there, but it's not passed yet. So that's the big push right now to prevent this kind of thing in the future, because I don't think there's an exact statistic, but they estimate that there's somewhere in the realm of 35,000 adoptees without citizenship in America right now. So it's a lot of people. Yeah.
All right, Caitlin, thank you so much again for taking the time to talk with me and for sharing some of the great insights you've been gathering so far. We'll obviously have to keep an eye out for the rest of your project and your work moving forward with the adoptee issues.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I hope everyone enjoyed this episode of Korean Context. If you did, please remember to like and subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever else you get your podcasts. And we'll see you here again next week.